Beloved Book One. Beloved Book One. The question was asked of Hayakujo. There is a sutra which says that not to perceive anything in terms of being or non-being is true deliverance. What does that mean? Hayakujo responded, when we attain to purity of mind, that is something which can be said to exist. When this happens, our remaining free from any thought of achievement is called not perceiving anything as existent. Reaching the state in which no thoughts arise or persist, yet without being conscious of their absence, is called not perceiving anything as non-existent. The Surangama Sutra says, perceptions employed as a base for building up possible concepts are the origin of all ignorance. Perception that there is nothing to perceive, that is nirvana, also known as deliverance. A question was asked, what is the meaning of the phrase, nothing to perceive? Hayakujo replied, being able to behold men, women, and all the various sorts of appearances, while remaining as free from love or hate as if they were actually not seen at all, that is what is meant by nothing to perceive. Then he was asked, that which occurs when we are confronted by all sorts of shapes and forms is called perception. Can we speak of perception taking place when nothing confronts us? Yes, replied Hayakujo. When something confronts us, it follows that we perceive it, continued the question. But how can there be perception when we are confronted by nothing at all? Hayakujo answered by saying, we are not talking of that perception which is independent of there being an object or not. How can that be? The nature of perception being eternal, we go on perceiving whether objects are present or not. Thereby we come to understand that whereas objects naturally appear and disappear, the nature of perception does neither of those things. It is the same with all your other senses too, concluded Hayakujo.
Manisha, before I discuss the sutras of Hayakujo and the haikus of Basu, I have to settle this great matter about Ananda. I call it the great matter because to me you all are Buddhas. You may know it, you may not know it. But into my vision, I perceive you in your perfection. And I want and hope that one day you will also be able to see clearly your Buddhahood. Because that is the only solution out of the troubles of mind. And an American famous Jewish writer, Joshua Liebman, has written a book, Peace of Mind. The very title is wrong. Mind can never be at peace. The peace is something beyond mind. Mind is the problem. You can change problems, but that will not help. You have to go beyond mind. I wrote a letter to Joshua Liebman. That your very title is wrong, your very attitude is wrong, you don't know a simple fact about the inner world. Mind is the cause of all trouble. Only no mind can be the peace. Because in a state of no mind, you have gone beyond the clouds into the open sky where problems don't exist. The mind is a small accumulation of thousands of years problems. You are still carrying them and they are waiting just for some situation to surface. Even you are surprised that from where this problem has surfaced, you were not aware. That 90% of your mind is in darkness. Only a small fragment, 10%, has become a little awake. He knows nothing what is going on in the depths of 90% of its own power. And from that unconscious, anything can surface to the conscious. Just a certain situation is needed to trigger it off. It may remain dormant for years, for lives, and it may become suddenly the greatest problem in your life. And this is not only a question about Ananda. It is a question for everyone who has a mind. Only those who have not a mind and function directly and straightforward without bringing any thoughts in between, rather than thinking, who simply reflect, they don't have any problems. To such people we have called Buddhas. You all have the potential of having mind or no mind. You can have both. When you need to work with the objective reality, you can use the mind. It is extrovert. And when you are working towards the inner world and the treasure house of your being, you have to use the no mind. The problem arises that you are accustomed to use the mind because you are accustomed of the outside world. So when you start working for the inner, you still continue the mind to function. That is not the area for function, for the mind. The mind can only be objective. It can never be subjective. And the moment you try to make it subjective, you will get in tremendous anguish, strange anxieties. The whole unconscious mind will start arising in flames within you. It is a great struggle of the mind. It does not want you ever to explore the inner. It wants you to remain engaged with something outside. It is perfectly happy turning in. Simply means a death to the mind. Turning in means the mind will have to be put aside with all its knowledge, its problems, its anxieties, its anguishes. Of course, the mind has been in power for 4 million years. It cannot easily give way. So it creates any kind of disturbances that can prevent you entering into your own being and finding the Buddha. Anando has written, "Beloved Bhagwan, I am sorry. It must be the most stubborn and stupid disciple of all time. I am not even sure I can be called a disciple after my behavior. I feel terrible that I forced you to hit me so hard. But I saw that my layers of pride and my stupid defenses of independence from love were so old and so thick that I needed something drastic. I still don't know what you did, except that boy, did it hurt. Now I understand why the truth is so unpopular. But in spite of my worst efforts, you with your love have managed a miracle. Again, I feel healed and so grateful. Thank you sounds so inadequate, but I say it from the depths of my being. I wash your feet with my tears of gratitude. Anando." Anando, you have done perfectly well. It was something troublesome in you that you have dropped in this crisis. This crisis was painful. Every crisis is. But few crises bring a new approach, a new attitude, a new being in you. And this crisis has brought a new dawn to your life. People don't understand at all that they are afraid of love. People think they are very loving, but their unconscious is very afraid of love, because love means merging, and that seems to the mind as if you are losing your independence, your individuality. In ordinary love affairs, it is true to some extent. That is the whole struggle between lovers, continuously fighting. It is not certain things that they are fighting about. Any excuse and they are fighting. Their fight is to survive as an individual. This flood of love creates great fear in them. But this is about the ordinary love affairs. What to say about the great love affair between the disciple and the master? It is a very tidal wave. But the difference is that the tidal wave will not take away your independence. In fact, you don't have independence right now. It is just a vague idea. You don't know freedom, you don't know independence. With the tidal wave of a master's love, all that is a slave in you will be drowned, and you will come out fresh, more independent, more individual, and yet more grateful, more peaceful, more graceful. And that's what has happened to you, Ananda. You have come back home. You have gone a little astray. But it is very difficult with me to go astray. I give you as much rope as you want. I give you the whole rope. And then you come with that whole load of rope back. You proved to be an authentic disciple. And what you are saying are not simply words. They are your very heart. When I hit someone, remember always, I hit myself more deeply. And I can understand that you are healed because my pain has disappeared. And I can feel your gratefulness. Not only I was feeling the pain through which you were going, the whole assembly was said. I would like, Anando, to bow down to all the Buddhas here. They were all said for all these days. You were in deep pain, fighting with it. You have come victorious. It is not enough to be grateful to me. You have to be grateful to all the Buddhas who are working here together in search of a last treasure, a last golden climate. It is not an organization of Buddhas. Buddhas don't organize. It is simply a meeting of brothers and sisters in a deep love, because they are all moving towards the same center of their being and the universal being. Anando, come before and bow down to the whole assembly. This will be a record for the future. Now the introduction part. The great pulse treatise on sudden enlightenment was written before he actually had any disciples, in the period described as when he lived a retired life, concealing his abilities and outwardly appearing somewhat mad. Even though the book is written in the style of a dialogue, Hayakujo composed the questions as well as the answers himself, so that he could explain his points in the manner he wished. The sutra. Beloved Bhagwan, the question was asked of Hayakujo. There is a sutra which says that not to perceive anything in terms of being or non-being is true deliverance. There is a sutra which says that not to perceive anything in terms of being or non-being is true deliverance. What does that mean? Hayakujo responded, when we attain to purity of mind, that is something which can be said to exist, when this happens, our remaining free from any thought of achievement is called not perceiving anything as existent. Reaching the state in which no thoughts arise or persist, yet without being conscious of their absence, is called not perceiving anything or non-existent. The Sarangama Sutra says, perceptions implied as a base for building up possible concepts are the origin of all ignorance. Perception that there is nothing to perceive, that is nirvana, also known as deliverance. A question was asked, what is the meaning of the phrase nothing to perceive? Hayakujo, even before becoming a master, has already become enlightened. It is not necessary for every enlightened being to become a master. Most of the enlightened beings have remained silent, for the simple reason that to say the truth is to annihilate the whole world. And not to say the truth, one feels betraying oneself. The situation of an enlightened man is a very difficult situation. He has all the blessings and all the joys, but there is a problem. He cannot communicate it to those who are moving in darkness, in blindness. And the trouble is, with enlightenment arises great compassion and love spontaneously. So the enlightened person tries to help in every possible way, creates devices, tells even lies to help you to come to the truth. But very few enlightened people are articulate, because that is a totally different expertise. So they remain silent, although their silence becomes heavy on them, and they become sad because they cannot communicate. They know the truth and somebody is searching for it, and they cannot even indicate the way. They feel so helpless. But few people who have become enlightened remained for few years silent, just pondering over the problem of communion. And that was the case with Hayakujo. He became enlightened and waited for the right moment that he has found the right words, right devices, which can help somebody. He wrote these sutras after his enlightenment, but before his becoming a master. He himself asked the question. It is a preparation for himself, the homework. He asked the question and he himself answers it, trying to see whether he will be able to answer the questions which are bound to arise when he declares his enlightenment. The one of the most difficult thing is, what is Nirvana? The word Nirvana has a very special meaning to it. No other religion in the world has ever dared even to think of such a thing. Nirvana literally means blowing away the flame. You have a candle, you blow away the flame. Now, where you can find that flame again? Is it possible to find that flame again in this vast universe? It has gone into the oceanic existence, become one with it. There is no way to find it. Buddha used Nirvana as the ultimate state when your individual consciousness disappears into the universal consciousness. It is just like blowing away a flame. No more you will be heard. No more you will be, only the existence will be there. You will walk and it will be existence who will be walking within you. You will talk and it will be existence which will be talking through you. You will become just a hollow bamboo. An existence can make a flute out of you. The words are the silences, are all coming from the cosmic sources. The enlightened masters have danced, have sung, have written poetries, have done all kinds of creative work, but not as themselves. They are allowing existence to use them as instruments of the cosmic soul. They will not do anything on their own. I am reminded of an English poet, Coleridge. After his death, 40,000 incomplete poems were found in his house. His friends were aware all his life and they insisted that, why don't you complete a poem which is so beautiful, just two lines more and it will be completed, or sometimes one line more and it will be completed. But Coleridge, according to me, was authentically a mystic poet. He simply said, I never write anything. I only allow existence. At this point, the existence is stopped. What can I do? I cannot manage to complete the poem. If existence wants to complete it someday, it will be completed. If not, it is not my concern. He completed only 7 poems. But even 7 poems have made him one of the greatest poets that has ever lived on the earth. His poems give the sense that they are coming from beyond. He is just a receiving center. He is not a composer. He is not writing them. He is just in the hands of existence, perhaps a fountain pen. But the hands are cosmic. And he was courageous enough. It needed immense courage to see thousands of poems gathering which can be completed. And he was capable of completing them. But he tried few times and he found out that that one line that he composes is dead, and the other lines that have flown through him have a life of their own. They have a heartbeat. Nirvana is disappearance into the ultimate. Even while living, you start living in the hands of the ultimate. And the ultimate is our freedom. The ultimate is our independence. Ananda has raised a question about independence in her letter. There are independences and there are great differences between them. One independence is from others. You are independent from others. That is a very small independence. That does not carry much meaning. Another independence is you are independent from yourself. That is the great freedom, the ultimate freedom. You are no more. As long as you are, there is a certain slavery to circumstances, to the body, to the mind, to the society. You cannot be absolutely independent as long as you are. Nirvana is absolute freedom. Now there is no one who can be enslaved. The dewdrop has disappeared into the ocean. These sutras are perfectly capable to make him a master, and finally he became a master, and he did not revise these sutras, he continued his whole life on the same line, the first sutra says that not to perceive anything in terms of being or non-being is true deliverance. Everything that you can see is just a reflection of the moon in the river. If somebody asks you, is the reflection of the moon in the lake has a being or it is a non-being, what you are going to say? It has none. Neither it is a being, nor it is a non-being. It is just a reflection in the mirror. So whatever you see with your eyes are just mirrors. Whatever you see around in the world, outside, you are simply reflecting them, you are not seeing them. And all your reflections are neither can be called as beings or as non-beings. What they are, just reflections. Your eyes are just mirrors. You don't have any way to find out what you are seeing is really there. Because all your senses can deceive you. And there is no way to judge whether you have seen something which is a mirage or real water. There is a great Christian college in Allahabad. I was invited for some lectures there. It is just on the bank of the great Ganges, in a very beautiful place. I was sitting by the side of the river bank with a friend who was a professor in the Christian college. And the friend became very excited. I said, what is the matter? Because far away there was a very beautiful woman. Taking a bath in the river. But her back was towards us. I said, what is the problem? Let her take the bath. He said, the problem is, I want to see her face. I said, you can go and see her face. He went with great excitement and came with so disappointed, because that was not a woman at all. It was a Hindu monk with great long hairs. When he saw the monk, he said, my God, I was just going to fall in love. I said, before falling in love, at least you should encounter the person from the front side. From the back side, and are you certain that he is a monk and not a woman? He said, you are creating doubt in me. For a moment, I was also doubtful, because he is beautiful. Now I will have to go back again. I said, leave it, now you know that he is a monk. He said, no, because you have created the doubt and I don't want to live with this doubt. He may be really a woman, because I did not see any beard or mustache. Who knows? My conclusion that he is a monk is dependent only on his orange clothes. But that is not a decisive point, because a Hindu woman nun will also use the orange clothes. He said, I will have to go. He went again. Even the monk became surprised that why this man is coming again and he looks from down to this way and that way. The monk said, what is the matter? He said, nothing is the matter. Just you have so beautiful hairs that I and my friend who is sitting there got into a discussion whether you are a man or a woman. The monk must have been a man of great sense of humor. He said, aha. I don't know myself. A monk is a monk. He is neither a man nor a woman. The man came even more disappointed. He said to me, now it is very difficult. His body is very shapely. And he himself says that he does not know who he is. what you can see with your eyes is only a reflection. Hayakuju is saying all our perceptions are neither beings nor non-beings. They are ephemeral. They are made of the same stuff as dreams are made of. Don't be too much concerned, attached, identified with them. That creates the bondage. Hayakujo himself responded to his question, when we attain to purity of mind, that is something which can be said to exist. When this happens, our remaining free from any thought of achievement is called not perceiving anything as existent. Nothing can be called as existent because everything is in a flux. This is a Buddhist attitude that you cannot call anything with a noun or a pronoun. Their approach is really deep. They say, you say the river is, but the river is constantly flowing. They are saying exactly what Epicurus and Heraclitus in Greece said, that you cannot step in the same river twice. When I read for the first time Heraclitus, that you cannot step in the same river twice, I tried. And my conclusion was that if I meet somewhere Heraclitus, not much chance, because he was a contemporary of Gautam Buddha. But one never knows. Everything is possible in this vast universe. I am going to tell him, you cannot step in the same river even once, because I have tried. You were simply postulating. When you put your feet in the river, the water is flowing. As your foot goes a little deeper, the water is flowing. A little more and water is flowing. By the time you touch the ground, perhaps so much water has gone, every second it is flowing, that you cannot say that you have stepped in the same river, in the same water. Gautam Buddha's very profound approach was that for mediocre reasons we have made all verbs into nouns. Otherwise, a tree should be called tree. It is continuously growing. At no point you can call it a tree. Either it is growing or it is dying. Everything is a process, not a thing. An event, but not a thing. And if everything is a process, you cannot call anything as being. The river is flowing. The water is flowing. The trees are growing. The stars are moving. The earth is moving. You are moving. The whole existence all around is in movement. There is not a single thing in the outside world which is not moving, either backwards or forwards. But movement is the reality. That's why it is called ephemeral. Only one thing is not moving, has never moved, and that is your ultimate center of being. That has remained the same in this whole world, around, going in circles. The great scientist Bacon can be called the father of Western science. Wrote a very great book, Novum Organum, in which he has stated in aphorisms the differences between philosophical attitudes and science. He says in Novum Organum, Novum Organum means new canon of thought, that if I can find a center in the world which is not moving, I can explain the whole world without any difficulty. But there is no center in the world which is not moving. Everything is moving. By the time you have explained, it is no more the same. He was not aware of the inner world. There is a center which is unmoving. But he was not a religious man. We are in search of a center inside, and all the mystics, all the Buddhas are in absolute agreement that in the deepest core of your being there is a center which is the only center in the whole existence, unmoving. And strangely enough, that unmoving center is not only yours. At that center we all meet. Just like lines drawn from the circumference to the center, you can draw many lines from the circumference to the center. On the circumference, there are different lines. As they move closer to the center, they also become closer to each other. When they reach the center, they are one. We are many on the circumference. At the center, we are one. And that oneness is the only freedom, because now there is no other to make you a slave. Only you are. And because only you are, you cannot even say that you are. To say that you are, you need for context others. Unless the other is, you cannot be. You need for your I a thou. Without a thou, the I cannot exist. Linguistically, it is impossible. So at the very center, only isness remains. Neither me nor you. But just a pure existence. The Saurangama Sutra says, perceptions implied as a base for building up possible concepts are the origin of all ignorance. Perception that there is nothing to perceive, that is nirvana. There is nothing to perceive, only you are. Only the mirror is there and nothing to reflect. So deeply we are rooted in one cosmic whole that there is no other which can be reflected. All around there is nothingness. But this nothingness is very alive. It is not the nothingness of a cemetery. It is the nothingness that you experience every day in meditation. Everything becomes absolutely silent. Somebody passing by the side of the road cannot infer that there are 10,000 people . This silence is vibrating, has a heartbeat. This is a small example of the ultimate silence that surrounds the cosmos. It has a heartbeat. It is not simply nothing. It is called nothingness because there is nothing to perceive. No reflection is made. When you go deep inside you, you will see no reflection is made. A pure mirror without any reflections. A purity without any ripples. This is, according to Buddha, is nirvana. A question was asked, What is the meaning of phrase nothing to perceive? How can you perceive nothing? You can perceive an object, a tree, a moon. You can perceive an object, but how can you perceive nothing? The question is very philosophical. But it is good to face it, because someday it may arise in you too, that when you are absolutely silent, just a mirror, nothing to perceive, how do you know? Nothing to perceive, can you perceive nothing? You can perceive no thing. And that perception of no thing gives you the idea of nothingness. There is no thingness around you, no objects. But just a pure space. Have you ever thought about the word object? We call things object. Object simply means that which obstructs, hinders, prevents. It is an objection. You cannot go. It is a barrier. Things are called objects because they prevent you from moving beyond them. They are like walls. They are not like doors. No object or no thing simply means there is nothing to object you around. This is the perception, that as far as you can see, there is no thing left. The mirror is pure, unreflective, centered in itself in deep blissfulness. Hayakujo replied, that which occurs when we are confronted by all sorts of shapes and forms is called perception. Can we speak of perception taking place when nothing confronts us? Yes, replied Hayakujo. When something confronts us, it follows that we perceive it. If we can perceive something, it means that when something will be removed, we will perceive nothing. The question continues, but how can there be perception when all confronted by nothing at all? Hayakujo answered by saying, "We are not talking of that perception which is independent of there being an object or not. How can that be? The nature of perception being eternal, we go on perceiving whether objects are present or not. A mirror can exist without reflecting." Just take that case that a mirror can exist without any reflection. A consciousness can exist without any perception. There is no need, no necessity. The mirror and its mirror quality is not dependent on anything, and its reflection. For example, the lake can go on existing whether the moon comes or not. If it comes, it will be reflected. If it does not come, who cares? The lake is perfectly satisfied unto itself. So is the case of the inner lake of consciousness. Thereby we come to understand that whereas objects naturally appear and disappear, the nature of perception does not neither of those things. The mirror remains, things come and go. Consciousness remains, awareness remains, witnessing remains, things come and go. Life comes, death comes. Your mirror-like witnessing remains. Eternally, it is the only thing in the whole existence which never changes. Basu wrote, "Autumn Eve, please turn to me. I too am a stranger. Basu's haikus have no parallel. All Zen masters have written haikus, but Basu seems to have melted and merged into nature more deeply than anybody else. Autumn Eve, please turn to me. I too am a stranger, just as you are." He is saying that here, in this world, we are all strangers. We ordinarily forget the matter. We start taking everybody for granted. Have you ever thought about it? These 10,000 Buddhas are all strangers. We make efforts to forget that everybody is a stranger. We make marriages, friendships. We try to introduce each other
just to forget the feeling of that everybody is a stranger. It will make us very much frightened that we are surrounded with strangers. All our families, all our clubs, all our religions, all our nations are only an opportunity to hide the fact that we are all strangers. And Zen is an effort to make you fully aware of your strangeness. This will give you freedom from the crowd. This will give you a sense of being yourself a deep intensity of consciousness that you are surrounded in a strange world where everybody is a stranger. And it has many deeper implications. If you can understand the fact that everybody is a stranger, all your expectations will drop. Who you are to expect? A husband expects certain things from the wife. He has forgotten the fact that the wife is a stranger. Just we have met on the way, talked a little bit, walked together on the way, and we have forgotten the fact that we are still strangers. We don't know ourselves, how we can know others? But on the surface, we try to make familiarity. We try to forget the fearsome idea that we are alone. The wife, the children, the Rotary Club. Somewhere we want to be associated. We don't want to stand alone in deep freedom under the sky and dance under the sun and the rain. No, we simply want a coziness with the crowd. We want to disappear in the crowd. It feels warmer there. It is not without any reason that Jesus could call people sheep and himself the shepherd, and nobody objected. This is strange that Jesus has been crucified, but nobody has ever objected to any of his things, and nobody has ever argued against him. The reality seems to be that people accepted it deep down themselves that they are nothing but sheep. They need a crowd to surround them. They cannot move alone. in an unknown territory. Nobody stood up to Jesus and said to him that you are insulting humanity, that you are humiliating us by being a shepherd and making us sheep. Nobody objected. Makes it clear that people felt that he is right. We need a crowd. What Basso is saying, Autumn Eve, please turn to me. You are not the only stranger here. I too am a stranger. I have heard an Englishman got down from the train, was feeling very dizzy. His wife has come to pick him up from the station. She asked, "What is the matter? You are looking very pale and dizzy." He said it was a difficult situation. Whenever I sit in the opposite direction, the train is going to the east, and I am sitting facing the west, it makes me dizzy. The wife said, "It is such a small thing. You could have asked anybody that it just makes me dizzy. Please change the seat." He said, "You are right. But we were all strangers. Nobody has introduced me to anybody." The wife said, "You are an idiot. We are strangers. That is true. But that does not mean that you cannot ask a small thing." He said, "Next time I will try." And the next day, he came even more dizzy. The wife said, "What happened now?" He said, "On the front seat, there was nobody. So I could not ask." You need somebody to ask. The seat was empty. The wife said, "I will not interfere in your matters. You are simply either a philosopher or insane. Both means the same." Another haiku by Basso, "The crescent moon, the eastern sky is dark, and the sound of a bell." He depicts in words without any colors. He makes paintings. the crescent moon. The eastern sky is dark, and the sound of a bell. You can almost hear the sound of a bell. These are his moments of meditation when he opens his eyes once in a while and something he sees, the crescent moon, the eastern sky is dark, and the sound of a bell. Just fragments out of a meditative mind, they don't say much, they simply depict a situation. Very visual, you can see it, you can hear it. Baso is very earthbound. Manisha has asked, beloved Bhagwan, although Baso's haikus are exquisite, they mostly tend to be a bit melancholy. I have always associated enlightenment with levity, if not ecstasy, although it seems that Krishnamurti did not expect much enjoyment from his enlightenment. Was Baso enlightened? Manisha, every enlightened being expresses himself in his own unique way. Baso certainly seems to be a little melancholy, but his sadness is not your sadness. Your sadness is a repressed anger. You may not have thought about it. You become sad in a situation where you cannot express your anger. For example, a husband and wife sitting together are always sad. For the simple reason that they are angry at each other. The wife thinks, what kind of idiot I have got? And the man is thinking, how to escape from here? Some excuse. Anger suppressed becomes sadness. But this is not the sadness of Baso. Baso is sad certainly, and his sadness also has a beauty. Your sadness is ugly. His sadness is about the whole world. It has nothing to do with himself. It is the sadness of a man who knows how easy and how close is your Buddhahood. And you are running here and there unnecessarily. The whole world is fighting, violent, angry. All this energy can transform their being into a Buddha. Baso's sadness is out of his compassion, it has nothing to do with anger. But your observation is right, that he seems to be a little sad in his haikus. He has to be. He is sad for you. He is sad for all the humanity. He is sad for all those who will follow him. Because he knows the truth, it is so close, just within your grasp, and still you don't raise your hand. That makes him sad. His sadness has a beauty and a splendor. As far as Krishnamurti, he was sad out of anger. But again, it was a different anger than your anger. Things are so subtle. He was angry that why people cannot understand him. He is so clear, so rational, why people cannot understand him. He used to beat his head before assemblies, that you have been listening to me for 40 years, 50 years, and I see at your face and I feel immensely sad. He suffered for almost 50 years with migraine, with so deep migraine that he has written in his diaries that sometimes he wanted to hit his head with the walls, and the migraine was nothing to do with his physiology. The migraine was that he was from the morning till the night talking to people, giving interviews, private interviews, and nobody was showing the light in their eyes that they have understood him. You cannot. Blame him for his anger. Although that is a very special case. But as I have told to you, every enlightened person encounters the world in his own unique way. Krishnamurti lived long, 90 years. And even at the last moment, he was angry. At the last moment, he said that I have wasted my whole life running around the world telling people, and they thought that it is an entertainment. I was talking about enlightenment, and they used to gather as if it is a circus. His anger is out of his compassion. But it is a very strange kind of conversion of compassion He was so insistent that you should understand what he is saying. This made him angry. He was against sannyasins. He was against me. He wanted to see me. And the people who had brought the message to me, we both were in Bombay. I said, I don't think there is any point. I am in absolute disagreement with him, and he is in absolute disagreement with me. So why unnecessarily waste my time and make him angry? He may hit his head to the wall, and unnecessarily I will be blamed for it. But I used to send my sannyasins to sit just in the front row in orange clothes with malas. That was enough. He will come, and as he will look around, he will forget completely what was the subject matter that he was going to talk about. He will immediately start talking against me and will become so angry that I cannot understand why these sannyasins are sitting in front of me. I am against these robes, I am against sannyas, and I have told my people that when he becomes angry, laugh, don't bother. That makes him more angry. And my sannyasins were all over the world, wherever he was speaking. My own understanding is that it was somewhat a little perversion of compassion. You should not be so insistent . You should make available whatever you have. If somebody chooses it, it is his freedom. If somebody does not, it is his freedom. You cannot impose your ideas upon others. Even though the ideas are about freedom, that was the difficulty with him. He was talking about freedom, but he wanted you to agree with his ideas about freedom. He could not see that even this is forcing slavery, a psychological slavery on people. You can simply share your vision of freedom, and that's all. It is up to people. If something rings a bell into their heart, good. If nothing rings into their hearts, what can you do? You cannot force somebody to freedom. And what kind of freedom that will be, which is forced, that you are free under machine guns. You you can simply give the idea and forget all about it. And as far as I am concerned, I consider enlightenment the greatest entertainment. Only the enlightened person can really entertain, enjoy, laugh. What miserable people can do about it? I refuse to meet him for the simple reason because I did not want him to be unnecessarily angry. He was sick, old. And he knew as well as I knew that there is no way to come to an agreement. I am a complete discontinuity with the past idea of entertainment or the past idea of enlightenment. He was still a very old type stubborn, and always thought that what he is saying is the only truth. There are many aspects to truth. There are many ways to present it. And all that a man of truth is needed is to share his vision lovingly, peacefully, with absolute freedom for anybody who wants to join in his exploration of reality. If somebody does not want to join, your anger is not right. Your anger shows that you were expecting that he should join. If you don't understand me, nothing is wrong. It is your freedom not to understand. I never take note of it whether you understand me or not. I go on my way. If somebody likes to be with me, a fellow traveler, as long as it is good, and if he wants to depart at a certain point, it is perfectly his freedom. But my approach and Krishnamurti's approach are bound to be different because I had no master in my life. That has given me a totally different space to work from because I have never been under a master, I can give you total freedom. I have enjoyed total freedom myself. I have never listened to anybody. I have just lived the way I wanted. And that is my message to you. Live the way you want. I can share my understanding with you. You can choose. There is no need for me to be angry. But Krishnamurti was forced to become enlightened. For 25 years, the theosophical movement, particularly the president of theosophical movement, Annie Besant, and one of the spokesmen of theosophical movement, Leadbeater, they kept him almost imprisoned. He was not allowed to meet ordinary people. Their idea was to present suddenly to the world a world teacher. So they were preparing the ground for a world teacher to come. Who will save the whole mankind? So they were spreading books, literature, that soon the world teacher is to appear. And they were hiding Krishnamurti and five other children, because who knows who will be right at the right time. The four were rejected, one died. Krishnamurti was chosen to be a world teacher, but he was completely trained for it. Even books were written in his name by Leadbeater. A great book at the feet of the master is supposed to be written by him when he was 13 years of age. And he himself does not remember. Later on asked, "Have you written this book?" He said, "I don't remember." The reality is he never wrote that book. That book, I have looked deeply into Leadbeater's other books. It is the same style. It is the same man, Leadbeater, who has written that book. In the name of J. Krishnamurti, to prove to the world that it is not an ordinary human being, it is a divine incarnation. At the age of 13, he writes such a great book. The book is certainly great. And Leadbeater was a very articulate writer, well-studied man. And he had chosen J. Krishnamurti and his brother Nityananda just when he was 9 years old. Those two boys were playing in the river near Adyar in Madras, where was the headquarters of Theosophical movement. Leadbeater saw those two boys swimming and enjoying in the river, throwing water at each other. And he was certainly a very perceptive man. He could see something great is possible with these two boys. And he has found three other boys. They all became great in their own fields. Nityananda died because of too much discipline. He was a very fragile person. You have to wake up at 3 o'clock. You have to go through all kinds of rituals. You have to listen to scriptures. You have to eat only certain things. And one of the great difficulty with Leadbeater was, he was a homosexual. And he abused every child, including Jai Krishnamurti, because there was a case against Leadbeater in Madras High Court. When the father of these two children, he was a poor man, a poor clerk, and his wife has died, so he was in trouble how to manage these two boys and his office. So when Leadbeater proposed the idea that any beast can adopt them, he was very happy. Any beast was world famous woman. He gave the adoption to Annie Besant, but it was found by many people that those small children are sexually abused by Leadbeater. So he appealed the High Court that I want my children to be returned back to me. They are homosexually abused by Leadbeater. And to avoid the situation, because the judge was ready that the children should be returned back, because there were witnesses of this abuse. Annie Besant, being a very famous British woman, managed to smuggle all those children to England before the orders were passed. This was easy for her because it was under British rule. And Annie Besant was a powerful woman. She managed to take them out of the country. Then those orders of the magistrate issued that the children should be returned back. But now the children were not there. She did not put those children, Jai Krishnamurti included, into any public school. It was such a guarded phenomenon that in public school he may start smoking, he may start behaving like ordinary students. He was kept almost a prisoner. Private tutors were teaching him, and all kinds of nonsense, religious, scriptural, was forced upon him. All this created a situation in which he revolted. A day was appointed when they were going to declare him as a world teacher, enlightened. In Holland, 6,000 representatives from all over the world of theosophical movement gathered. And at the last moment when he was going to declare, he stood up and he said, "I am not a world teacher and I refuse to be the head of any organization, a special organization." The Star of the East was made for him, which will work for the world teacher, a section of the theosophical movement. He carried his whole life those wounds, those 25 years he could not forgive his teachers. It is a very strange case and a tragic case. So when he was speaking, he was not free from his past experiences. He was still fighting against those teachers who have forced him. I don't think that he was really enlightened. He had the capacity and the intelligence to become enlightened, and he was very close to enlightenment. The only barrier was his hatred, anger about his masters and their behavior with him. That anger continued as an undercurrent. I love the man. He has contributed great insights to the world, but he himself remained just close to enlightenment, but he was not a Gautam Buddha or a Matazu or a Hayakujo. I feel sad to say it because I love him. His insights are very clear. But something is pulling him back. He could not open up in a full flower. something remained hanging around him, around his psychology, he was not a man of absolute freedom. Although he was talking about it, he was a sincere man, otherwise he would not have refused to be the world teacher. He knew that he is not enlightened and this will be insincere, dishonest to declare himself as the world teacher. I love his honesty, but that does not mean I have to say that he was enlightened. Perhaps next life, this life he missed, and he missed because of his teachers. Now it is Anando time. Loony Larry is bobbling home from the pub along the railway tracks. It is a full moon night and Larry is well plastered with rum. All of a sudden, he trips over a human leg lying on the tracks. He picks himself up, rubs his eyes in disbelief, and staggers on. A few minutes later, he stumbles over another leg lying on the tracks. Next, he comes across an arm. By now, Loony Larry has become really interested, and when he sees a body, he stops to have a good look at it. Walking around the body, he scratches his chin and mumbles to himself, "That coat looks rather familiar. I wonder if it is." But just then he steps backwards and falls over a head. He stares in drunken shock at the head, recognizing the face of his friend Harry. Then Larry sees an ear lying on the ground a few feet away. He crawls over to the ear, picks it up and shouts into it, "Harry, Harry, are you all right?" Father Fumble is giving confession one day when Seamus comes in and tells him that he has been having an affair. "I see," says Fumble, "but I cannot bless you until you tell me the woman's name." "Okay, father," replies Seamus. "She is the most gorgeous blonde you have ever seen, and her name is Pussy Green." The next Sunday, Father Fumble is getting ready for Mass when a stunning blonde in a tiny skirt wiggles down the aisle to the front seats. Father Fumble fumbles, for his glasses, slips them on and takes a good look at her. "Is that pussy green?" he whispers to little Albert, the chore boy. Albert looks hard, this way and that. "No, father," he replies, "I think it is just the reflection from the stained glass windows." Pope the Pollock arrives at New Delhi airport on the first leg of his $10 million Catholic mission to the East. The Pollock steps off the plane and immediately falls to his knees weeping and then kisses the runaway. Cardinal Singh, the head of the Indian Catholic Church, rushes up to the Pollock Pope and helps him to his feet. "My goodness, Holy Father," cries the Cardinal, "why did you do that?" "Well," says the Pollock, wiping his lips and drying his eyes, "have you ever flown Air India?" I have been calling Nivedano's drums Anando up to now. To hit her so deep that she goes through the breakthrough. She has gone through it and it is a joy and blissful evening for every of you. The drum will still be called for this series Anando, but for other reasons. To welcome her home. Anando. Close your eyes. Feel your body to be completely frozen. Look inward. with great urgency, as if this moment is the last moment of your life. Only with great urgency you can reach to your Buddhahood. It is not far away. Just gather all your consciousness into an arrow. It is an unknown path for you, but go ahead. There is no fear. Nobody is ever harmed by reaching to the life source, deeper and deeper. At the center of your being is the unmoving, center in the whole existence. To be it is to have found the treasure house of all the mysteries and miracles. Just look without any evaluation, without any judgment. Be a mirror, only reflecting. A witness, just a witness with no idea, no opinion. To make it clear, Nivedana, watch, witness, your body is not you, your mind is not you. You are just a pure witness. This is your Buddhahood. The evening was beautiful on its own, but your experience of witnessing has made it tremendously beautiful. Rejoice in the experience, because you have to live it out 24 hours of the clock. The experience of being a Buddha is not something for few moments or few hours. It is for your whole life. And unless it is for your whole life, all your actions, all your gestures, it is not worth You have to become a Buddha. It is only a recognition. Nothing has to be done. You are already a perfect Buddha. Just recognize it and rejoice in recognizing it. And let it become an undercurrent in all your actions, responses, gestures, waking, sleeping. Let the undercurrent become more and more deeper. At this moment, there are not 10,000 Buddhas, but only one oceanic Buddhahood. You have all merged into a tremendous experience. Collect as many flowers as possible, as much fragrance as possible. Soon you will be coming back from your life source to the circumference. Bring something from your treasure house with you. Don't come as you have gone in. Come transformed. Nibbidanna. Come back slowly, silently, gracefully, and sit down for a few moments just to recollect the experience. Okay, Manisha?
Yes,
Bhagwan. Can we celebrate the 10,000 Buddhas?
Yes, Bhagwan.